White Network presents Hitler's Table Talk, Study Out. Reading and commentary on the after-dinner monologues delivered by Adolf Hitler from 1941 to 1944 and transcribed by Aides.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. A big welcome to our new study hour at the White Network, which, as you heard, is Hitler's Table Talk by, guess who, the man himself. And my co-host for this brand new program is Ray Goodwin, someone who many of you will know, some of you might not know. So I'm going to ask Ray to tell us a little bit about himself. And I will say before that, that Ray and I have been friends since 2007. And Ray is a fellow Texan. And since I've known him, I've been a Texan too. So that's why we can be fellow Texans. So hi, Ray.
Hi, Carolyn. Nice to be home.
Yeah, thank you. Well, it's nice to have you on, and I'm just really thrilled about what we're going to be studying, and I know you are too.
Mm-hmm, definitely.
All right, so why don't we start out by you just talking, telling listeners a little bit about yourself, how you came to see the light, how you came to be a pro-National Socialist person, and some of the things that you've done.
Well, my curious mind started wondering about this way back when I was in junior high and high school, whenever we would study World War II. It never made sense to me that the big deal was made out of Japanese bombing Pearl Harbor and dragging us into that war, that we backed off from the Japanese and threw everything we had at Germany, which had not done anything to us. And I thought, that doesn't make sense, and especially then reading later that our troops in the Pacific were often short of ammunition, of food, everything else, because we were doing everything we could to crush Germany. And that really didn't make any sense to me. I didn't get any answers, though, from history teachers in high school and college, not much at all. Then I went into workforce, and ironically, one day at work, a fella handed me a little kind of a newspaper weekly reader thing, and it was titled, Did 6 Million Really Die? Or, you know, whatever. And so I read that, and it really piqued my interest. I said, well, it's fascinating. I don't know if it's just propaganda or what. But I started digging, actually a little before that, around trying to find some answers here and there, and I stumbled onto some revisionist history. And boy, when I hit that, Carolyn, it was like a gold mine to me, and I couldn't tear myself away from it, and I'm still that way today. And over the years, you know, I personally met Tyler Kent and had him as a guest in my home a couple of times, and I learned a lot from Mr. Kent about what really went on regarding Roosevelt and Churchill and trying to get us into that war. And so it didn't take much to realize that the establishment version of history couldn't be further from the truth. And so, you know, it just piqued my interest, and I kept on. And I've subsequently written articles for the Barnes Review. I've attended three or four conferences where I've been a speaker, one of the speakers on the agenda regarding various facets of revisionist history, and bias in academia was one of my talks and things like this. So I've kind of grown into this, and the more I learned, and I read Mein Kampf, and I read books by Joseph Goebbels and Rosenberg, I thought, you know what, these guys are not the devil incarnate that it's been painted to us. And then I started really learning about The Chosen by reading Henry Ford's work. So just kind of like most revisionists out there, self-educated, if you will, grateful to some friends for passing on such pamphlets and all to me, and Mr. Kent was one of those. But anyway, that's how I've arrived to where I am now.
You've also been a college level teacher.
Yes, for a while,
which gives you a ability to deal with texts and so on, and understand what you're reading.
Sure. When I got out of high school, which was 1961, I went into our local community college that fall. And I got in a little over 2 years of work there, but then I went to work in the workforce for the DuPont company here, and a year later got married and then raised a family and all that stuff. And through a set of circumstances, with a medical retirement because of a back operation I'd had, well, decided to go back to school almost 30 years later. I went back to school in 1991 and completed my BA in history. And then thought, well, what the heck? Now, went on and got an MA. And the director of the local college's history division called me, and he had had me as a student way back. And he said, hey, he said, you get that MA yet? I said, yes, sir, just finished it. He said, come see me. So I went to see him, and he said, we could really use people like you in the classroom. And would you be interested in being on our adjunct faculty? I said, I certainly would. I always wanted to teach. So that's how I got my start. That was 1996. And I was there until the spring. I finished the spring semester of 2002. And so in the classroom, you know, teachers today have to be careful what they say because of the ears listening. To pick up anything that might be offensive to those who consider themselves the directors of our moral codes and everything else. But still, I was able to interject a lot of revisionist history. I took issue with the history text that we were assigned to teach out of on several instances. And I think my students, therefore, got a much more rounded outlook for history and appreciation of history than they would have otherwise. And so I enjoyed my time there as an instructor.
Ray, I know you're a good one too. You could be, I'm a lot louder than you. I can see that. I'm watching the sound level. So if you could, I don't want to ask you to change your Skype settings now, but if you just, speak up a little bit louder for this program, we'll get that adjusted. That's better.
Okay, good deal. All right.
And I'll try to talk more quietly. then people can adjust their volume to that. So there we are. Now, Ray, you had worked up some questions, weren't they? Four questions that you thought, and I thought they were just excellent. So we're going to go with those. So why don't you start out with your, so what we're going to talk about today, listeners, is on this first program, is giving some background about this book and all the questions about it. And if you look around the internet, you will see people saying, oh, this book is a forgery, or this book is not reliable, and in many kind of ways. And then some people arguing otherwise, and it gets very confusing. So we're going to try to cover a lot of this, and before we get started with the actual reading next week. So Ray, you start us off here.
Okay. First of all, I have to admit, I had never heard of this book until you mentioned it to me a few weeks ago. Amazingly, because, you know, I've read so much about National Socialist Germany and Adolf Hitler and all, but I had never come across this book in any way, shape, or form. And when you mentioned it to me and I got online and did a little looking, I was fascinated, and I'm certainly looking forward to going into this book with you. And I think that as far as I'm concerned, and probably you too, our main purpose in selecting this book and reading it and discussing it is to evaluate that number one thing about this book. Is it authentic? Does it have legitimacy? Is it actually the words of Adolf Hitler himself? And that's a question that we will try to determine as we go along in this book. And, you know, the conclusions that we reach may be that, hey, most of it certainly is probably written by Hitler. There might be a little change here and there. And it went, you know, may not be. But the only way we're going to find out is to read it. So,
yeah, well, let me correct some misstatement you just made, and that was written by Hitler, excuse me. Because it's definitely not written by Hitler.
No, I said were the word. I meant to say were the words of Adolf Hitler.
Yeah, yeah. I know yeah. That's what you meant to say. So one thing we want to make sure that people understand is that this book was transcribed by note takers, and it is. Well, I have kind of an interesting little story about that. That maybe I'll start out with here, if I can find it. I get so much stuff here. Let's see, where do I have that? In that, can't be this far down. Oh, yeah, here, it's all in this blue stuff. You know, and that is that one of the arguments that's put forth against it is that Martin Bormann, who was Hitler's personal secretary, he's so unpopular in general with people, and they always are, you know, he's been accused after the fact here of being a Soviet spy and being a total traitor and being the one that caused so many problems with the war on the Eastern Front and so on, which I want to say I don't buy into at all, not one little bit. But that's part of the problem that a lot of people bring up for this book, and that Bormann edited the notes, or the notes that were taken by aides of Martin Bormann, and that then they were given to him to check over afterwards, and that he had every opportunity, which he did, to change them and rewrite them the way he wanted to. Although these note takers didn't say so, although one said, made us kind of an allusion to something once about it, but he didn't really make much out of it. And that Bormann had some different ideas than Hitler, and so that's why these ideas are in there. I did some translation, as you know, Ray, with Wilhelm Christman for over a period of a few years, mm-hmm. translating this, actually he did the translation, but translating this book by Hermann Giesler, Ein anderer Hitler, which translates into Another Hitler. And Hermann Giesler was Hitler's personal architect. He was as much Hitler's architect as Albert Speer, but he wasn't the great fellow that, you know, Speer was more important, and Speer was more
more authority.
Yeah, well, I guess Speer was more talent in a sense, you know, had grander ideas, and he did them, some of the most, he did Berlin and stuff, whereas Giesler was taking care of things in Munich, and then he was doing all this designing for the renovation of Linz, which is a very special project of Hitler's. And so they worked closely together over these years, throughout the war years. And Giesler then wrote his memoirs. And there's a lot in there that's very, very interesting. And in one couple places, he talks about Bormann. He got to know Bormann better, and he got to like him and think better of him than he did previously, because Bormann was not all that popular amongst the National Socialists either. Mm-hmm. He was the head of he was the party secretary, kind of, I think that was his actual title, but he was, you know, in charge of the party after a while, after some of these people were dying or whatever, and so he finally took over, and Hitler depended on him a whole lot. Mm-hmm. And in the very last segment of the Ein anderer Hitler translations that we did, let me find that one. Well, darn it, I'm always doing this. I'm always losing where I'm at. I've got the one thing here, but I don't have the other one. I don't know why. I got it somewhere else, I guess. Who knows? Well, I'll just have to, I'll just say it by memory. It was one of the last times that Giesler was at the Führer bunker, and it was 1945 already, February 1945. Mm-hmm. And he was going to be leaving, and he was there for dinner. And when he was there with Hitler, he and Hitler usually had dinner alone, because Hitler liked having dinner alone with him. And then they worked on their architecture and stuff. But in this case, a lot of things were happening. And he was there at the dinner that everybody shared. And Hitler was speaking after the meal. Mm-hmm. And Giesler said that the phone rang, and he was called away to answer the phone. Hitler was, and he whispered to Bormann, who was sitting there. Bormann was always there too, and said to him, "This is so." He said he was so impressed by what Hitler was saying. He said it was so well put together, and it was so well thought out, and it was just so he had not heard a lot of that at dinner time talk before. And he said to Bormann, "This should be recorded." He said, "This is so too important to just be lost." And Bormann said back to him, "I've been working on it for some time." So I thought that was an interesting confirmation, so to speak, from another aspect but at that time they weren't doing it. In 1945, they weren't doing it, supposedly.
Right.
They stopped in 1945. But anyway, this other one was Giesler was talking about his opinion, his experience with Bormann. Because during the Valkyrie assassination plot, you know, the July 20th,
yes,
1944 assassination plot, the big one. After that, Giesler was at the Führer bunker, and he was doing some things and stayed there for a while. And Hitler was cluing him in on the whole plot and what happened, what they learned about it, who was guilty, and, you know, what the consequences were and so on. And he told him to go to Bormann's office. And, well, Bormann's office was right next to his. Not that he had an office, and Bormann would give him the papers to read, you know, the informations and so on that he had there, that he kept in the safe and all. And so he was spent some time in Bormann's office reading up on all of this information. And so here he describes it here. He describes Bormann. Here he was sitting with his shirt sleeves rolled up during the high summer heat. With a lively alertness and immense industriousness, he worked through piles of files, dictated and phoned without a break. He had the endurance of a fighting bull. I think Adolf Hitler saw him correctly when he told me once, "Bormann is like his signature, and that is like the Hohe Gül." That's that, he means a high mountain peak that was a famous one called the Gül that was outside of his, that could be seen from his home in the Berghof down south. But anyway, that's here nor there. But he said, "I was often present," Giesler says, "I was often present at that time when Bormann reported to Hitler. He did so in a matter-of-fact and concentrated way, with all the pros and cons, mostly about very important matters. Sometimes, when persons and happenings were involved that I was familiar with, I could see how clearly and correctly it had been reported." I think that's important. I experienced that myself, that when I know something about something, I can tell whether what's being said is true or not, right? You know, I mean, you know.
Okay.
When you don't know, it's amazing how little we know. When we don't know, we don't know what's wrong with what's being said.
Mm-hmm.
And this is everything that goes on with us in the internet. You go around and you hear things, you read things, and you don't know otherwise, so you tend to believe it. And it takes a huge amount of actual learning to know whether you can believe something or not. Mm-hmm. But anyway, he goes on and says, then Adolf Hitler decided it, you know, after he told him the pros and cons and whatever, all the information about it. That information given to the Führer covered all areas of the state, the party, and the whole civil sector, and lasted sometimes hours. I was drawing while this was going on, but I still listened carefully. A little later, I was again sitting in my corner with my refreshments there, reading the reports or silently watching Bormann at work. He often dictated to two or three secretaries at a time, but rather strange and surprising, at the same time that Bormann dictated to give the gist of the matter, he memorized Hitler's decisions word for word, followed the sentences exactly as they were spoken by Hitler, while in between he shaped the letters and orders, that means the documents, letter documents, order documents, that derived from them, from Hitler's decisions. Telephone calls came in, disturbing messages were handed to him, after which he continued dictating where he had stopped before. And then he says that sometimes, talks about how Bormann was, a lot of people had quarrels with him, he wasn't always so popular, he was too big, he gave off a big shadow like the Hohego mountain. Sometimes he said, I had real quarrels with him, or he with me. Twice Hitler intervened and said, Giesler, please go along with Bormann. He said, once at the Berghof spring 1944, Hitler said to me, Giesler, if you want to drive away from here early, mad, because of Bormann, but you are Mrs. Bormann's guest and you are also my guest. No, you cannot do that to us. By the way, let it be said to you, in that case, I guess the case that was in dispute there, Bormann acted absolutely correctly. He naturally should have given you some explanation, which I'm doing now. And then he said to him, Giesler, I need Bormann and his working strength. Either then or some other point, some other time, I don't know, but he said, Giesler reports that Hitler said to him, I need Bormann and his working strength. He relieves me. He is steady, unshakable, and an achiever. I can depend on him. Giesler says, in retrospect, I always found out on my own that Bormann was correct to get tough on me, or that he acted on Hitler's order. And then he just says that Bormann noticed everything. It reflected his former job as an estate administrator. Well, the reason I think that's important to read in this first program is because Bormann plays a big role, since this whole book is sometimes called the Bormann Vermerke, which is like
notes
Bormann notes. Yeah. And they make a big deal in some case. And I read some places where those who don't like the book want to call it the Bormann manuscript or something, as though it's all Bormann, you know, as though it's not Hitler at all. Bormann wrote this because he had the opportunity to do with it what he will. But the point is that Hitler put a lot of trust in Bormann, and he felt he certainly felt he could, you know. I mean, Bormann didn't let him down. And I believe from something else that Bormann had said to Giesler, which I'm not quoting here, but it was to the extent of that all I want to do is to serve the Führer and take the load off of him, you know, help him in whatever way I want. And that's the only thing I'm asking. That's the only thing I want. And Giesler said, I believed him. And because I think a lot of Giesler too, and you know, I believe it too. You know, sure. That's my feeling about Bormann. So you have strong feelings of pro and anti Bormann amongst people.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, you know, the value of that book, and that's one of the main reasons for considering to read it and whatever, is what kind of value does it have?
A little bit louder, Ray, if you can. I hate to bug you about it, but
okay.
Yeah.
All right. The value in that book is that we could learn, have a little more insight into the mind of Adolf Hitler. Now, there were two fellas taking down what Hitler would say at these meals and other functions, and they would take them down in shorthand and give that to Bormann.
No, they didn't give the shorthand to Bormann. They typed it up afterwards.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, the one guy certainly.
That's right. That's him. Right. And then Bormann edited, or let's say.
And then they gave it. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And so Martin Bormann was definitely a key toward what we're reading today, and played a big part in that. So the thing about that is, my next big key on this is the translation. Certainly, all this was originally written down in German, and then the work was translated into French, and then into English, along about, I think it said the original book of this whole thing came out in 1951 in the German, in a 52 in French, and a 53 in English. Well,
that's right.
I know that in all, just about all translations of any work, and you know whether that ranges from the Christian Bible to anything, if it's translated into from one language to another, usually there's at least a little of it that's lost in translation from one language to another, and that's you know, another thing to be considered there when critics jump all over this. And that was a particular criticism of one of the fellows named Dietlif Busch, and not without reason, you know. And he kind of makes you
And Dietlif is a commenter here at the White Network. He's a good guy.
Yeah.
But he's very much a Christian, and he does tend to. I need to stop talking so loud. And he does tend to want to defend that at all costs. But he was following what this Richard Carrier has written.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's kind of become the major, from what I can see, the major opponent of the book based on the fact, maybe not the whole book, but the Christian parts, mm-hmm. and says that they were tampered with by Genoux,
yes.
And that maybe they weren't. Maybe Bormann played a part in that too, probably, they think, and things
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, that's where there's a
real Christian argument, because Christians who, I guess, like, you know, if Christians don't like Hitler, they are happy if he's not Christian, right? But if they do like Hitler and they think that he's a Christian, that, you know, they like a Christian Hitler, then they don't like this book because he says some things that are unfriendly to Christianity.
Yeah,
right. Go ahead.
Well, critics like Bush raise important questions, and you know, did Bormann and or Genoux change any of the words to what they would have said? But when that publication came out, and I'm sitting here, and I'm thinking about this book, and I know a little bit about it, and I'm thinking, wow, you know, if this book was totally pro-Hitler and National Socialist Germany, it never would have seen the light of day, in my opinion. My thought was, who this book would be more likely to offend? Is there material in this book that would offend pro-National Socialist Hitler people, or the anti-National Socialist Hitler people, pro-Hitler Christians will be offended by it? You just mentioned that, but you know, my opinion that anything in it that offends the typical anti-Hitler crowd is pacified kind of at the start by that Hugh Trevor Roper introduction and preface with his evil Hitler. It's typical of any writing about Hitler National Socialist Germany that it's always prefaced by or lead into by someone who writes and says, well, you got to remember this is the evil villain that exterminated the Jews and all this stuff, and this probably was mentally unbalanced. You always got to put up with that kind of garbage leading into the work. Mm-hmm.
Did you find that?
Did you find that introduction?
Oh
no, I couldn't find it, but I found reference to it where one critic had said it would have been much better. The book would have been a little bit more enjoyable. It didn't need the introduction by Trevor Roper, the anti-Hitler, hate Hitler introduction by him. Let us make up our own minds here instead of trying to precondition us with those words. Mm-hmm. And so, and it was funny too that one reviewer stated that if you take out the racism and the anti-Jewish statements, Hitler's comments about culture, philosophy are actually palatable, you know. And so, speaking of who it would offend, and then I read about Dietlef Busch's criticisms of it, and like you say, he leans heavily on the comments of Richard Currier, and Currier actually said that Table Talk was entirely untrustworthy. And being as how both of those gentlemen are Christians, they naturally would take offense at the sharp criticism of Christianity that is presented pretty early, right off the bat in that book. And in their minds, Adolf Hitler would never have said such a thing. And so naturally then they say that the work is not worth considering as the words of Adolf Hitler. So, you know, you're dealing with that.
From what I understand is I can't get a definite answer to what I want to know. Uh-huh. And that is that we know that it was, of course, taken down in German. And there's a book put out by Picker, who published his notes in 1951 in the original German. And this is what Hasso Kastrup was. He had this, and this is what he was going. He knows what's in there. And then Genu, who had purchased it from Bormann's wife for a large sum of money.
Right.
And he had the German, Bormann's notes, Bormann's German version. And he translated it into French, excuse me, in 1952. Well, then, if Stevens and Cameron translated it into English, I don't understand why they would use his French translation to translate from when there was a German version that Genu had. Mm-hmm. So I can't understand why they would do that, and I have never seen it written that they actually translated it from the French, except in people talking about it, and this Currier says that, but he doesn't offer any why we should believe that. And I'm looking to find out, I want to know with evidence how this Trevor Roper version that we're using, which is the only one that's available in English, if that was translated from the German or from the French. And, you know, in the PDF on the copyright page, it doesn't say, it says they translated it, but it doesn't say what language they translated it from.
Correct.
I find all that very strange.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes me mad when they don't give you the information that they should give you.
Well, you know, since there were a lot of words quoted in there from Dietlef Busch about his criticism of that, I read that what he had to say. He does raise some good points, and he falls back mostly, you know, saying that those translations were corrupted probably by Bormann, and he made a reference to Bormann's deism or being a deist. Which offends a lot of Christians because of their, you know, deism being a belief in a higher power via reason and not revelation. And so he therefore doubts the authenticity of this Table Talk. And he even, quoting Dietlef here, says, "What importance can the Table Talk be? It is of importance only when it agrees with the public record." Well, then I'm reading that and I'm thinking, well, what the hell is the public record? You know, it has to come directly from Adolf Hitler, or I wasn't quite sure what he meant. And then another observation was only those books that contained something of value to the Jews were likely to find a publisher. But you got all of this going in there. And then I saw that Albert Speer confirmed the authenticity of the Table Talk in 1976. I guess he came out, was asked about it or whatever, and offered his comments. And Speer uses the same kind of negativity in his phraseology and discussion of Adolf Hitler that a Jew would use, or a brainless non-Jew historian. And, you know, he made remarks like Hitler giving those talks. He said he was always trying to impress his, quote, superiors by birth and education, unquote. And to me, I laughed at that. I thought, my gosh, what he's saying here is something like saying, let's say Mensa, the highest IQ'd member in Mensa was trying to impress a meeting of his organization. I mean, Hitler's mind was so brilliant, and we know that on so many subjects, subjects. And Albert Speer is saying that Hitler was boring with his talks, and he always was trying to impress those who were his superior by birth and education. So, you know, whatever.
Well, Albert Speer is known to have turned after Hitler's death and after the trial, and maybe even before that. During the trial. But, you know, he then turned to, in order to please those who were in power then. And he maybe hoped that he would get his 20-year sentence reduced, but they never did reduce it. Before he served the entire 20 years before he got out. Mm-hmm. But I have something, a section that we, Wilhelm Christman and I also translated from the Giesler book about Speer, because Giesler and Speer worked together, or had to, you know, butt heads quite a bit, being they were both doing building projects. And I keep forgetting about it. I need to take some time. I need to get it ready and put it up on my website. I'm going to do that one of these days, because it's there, and it says a lot about Speer, but there's a lot that's already known about his turncoat, because he was totally loyal to Hitler until after it was all the defeat and everything, and after Hitler was dead. So he there's not much to admire about him. It's too bad, because he was a brilliant man too.
All right. Yeah. That's true.
Well, you said something, the public record, and that's a big thing that these people will say, because Hitler in the 1920s in speeches said he was a Christian. Talked positively about Christ as a fighter and as an example and all of these things. And I believe he was sincere.
Yes.
And even in the 30s, when he was, when this person, Wagner, not Richard Wagner, but yeah. Wagner, can't think of it, Otto Wagner, who was working closely with Hitler for about 3 years as Hitler was trying to get together a government, you know, I mean, a bunch of people and advisors who were really good and have a program and everything in order to take over the government if he got the chance. So this was in maybe 29, but in 30, 31, 32, and part of 33, probably not 29. He wrote a book called, what is that called? Anyway, Hitler Confession something. What he remembered, and he did it all from memory too, but he had Hitler speaking, positively about Christianity, in many cases, but not quite the same as what Hitler said in those speeches in the mid 20s and earlier. Some of it was 1921. But so now then we've got Hitler going through his entire, time as chancellor, and now we're in the war, and now we're in 1941, and Hitler's being critical of the church, basically, and of the official religion of Christianity and some of the ideas and so on. Right. In his private conversation with his inner circle, while he's kind of, you know, relaxing and letting off, you know, from all the difficulties of the day and so on. And many things are said when you're talking like that around a table with people. You know, it's not, even though he was told they had to have his approval to record these talks. And so Borman wanted to do it. And then people will say, oh, he wanted to do it because he knew he could change it all and put forth his ideas. See, you know, but yeah. Borman realized that a lot of people said, gee, these talks are so brilliant, you know, and they're just going into empty space there. And something should be saved from all of this. And so Borman got Hitler to agree to having note taking. Hitler said that he would not, agree to having recording machines in there. He didn't want it to be what's that called? That recording
network. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But he did agree to having these aides sitting there and taking notes. Mm-hmm. And then they were. I think that the whole idea then was not, well, we're going to publish this, you know, to the world, but it was that this was going to be for the National Socialist Party, and that this was going to be for the future regimes, you know, after he was gone or when he couldn't run things himself, all you just to save for themselves, for their own organizations, this what Hitler was talking about, to have his thoughts on all these things. So Hitler was probably, I think, pretty easy about it. He forgot about it. Maybe he wasn't thinking about it. Oh, what I'm saying here is being taken down for posterity, you know.
Yes.
So he just went on talking freely. And so I see nothing strange about the things he said.
Neither do I.
That people would go, yeah, there we go, that people would get so up in arms about it.
Yes. I personally, you know, like to think that he was just a very practical man. He was certainly a politician, but I don't mean that in the negative sense that you say politician today, but politically shrewd.
I like to say that he used the political system.
Yes.
But
yes.
I wouldn't call him a politician. He didn't set out to make a living
a
as a politician.
Yeah, that's right. And you know, about that remark made about Borman being a deist and his deist thinking, you know, caused these anti-Christian remarks. Well, Thomas Jefferson was a deist, as were a handful of the other founding fathers, and thank God for that, because if they had baggage encumbering them, like the Church of England or the Christian religion, I don't think our Declaration or our Constitution would have come out worth a flip. We'd never would have had separation of church and state. So, you know, calling somebody that or making reference to that, you know, Martin Borman and Thomas Jefferson being deists, that's pretty good company as far as I'm concerned.
Well, a lot of people call Hitler a deist.
Uh-huh.
They'll say it basically. He was a deist. He believed in providence. He spoke about providence and,
exactly,
you know, and
higher power.
Later on, he didn't talk like a Christian.
Right.
But he always spoke well of Christ, and he didn't want to offend Christians, or he didn't see anything wrong with them. Germans had been Christians. He realized that Christianity was deep in the German mind and habits and behavior, and he didn't see any reason to mess with that or try to upset it.
That's right. And,
you
know, I was just going to say, and Jefferson did that same thing. He knew better than to come out in the open, openly proclaiming his Christian beliefs or his deist beliefs. But, you know, he certainly went in Rome, gave the talks and said the words that the people actually needed to hear. And that's practicality, you know, and I see that as the shrewdness of a man who's got a goal and is trying to reach it and doesn't want to alienate. And so, you know, and that's why what we've read right off the bat about Hitler's table talk, all the criticism is based on his supposed denigration of Christianity. And so, you know, I'd like to take those critics and I would like to ask them, what did you think about his words about culture, or his words about philosophy, what his own personal aspirations were, how his feelings towards his enemies and friends were? What did you think about that? Put aside your animosity towards that book based on religion and just throwing the baby out with the bathwater, saying, well, if this book says Hitler says this, then it's worthless because I know he couldn't have said this. But I think there are gems, G-E-M-S, gems in this book to be found. And I'm looking forward to discovering them as we go along.
I certainly am too. Somebody made a comment. I was looking at this Stormfront thread this afternoon, and there are some very good comments and some not so good comments, but I guess it depends on what side of this issue you're on. Mm-hmm. But one person said, who made a few other good comments, he said, every time someone says that this book is a forgery, you quite possibly deter someone who possibly would have bought it from doing so. Mm-hmm. It's a great book and a real eye-opener. Everyone should own a copy, whether you're religious or not. And, you know, I could identify with that because I didn't read it for a long time because I thought, I heard too much about it being not
worthless.
A forgery, mm-hmm. but having statements about from Hitler that weren't true, and I understood that they are mostly about Christianity, but I thought I don't want to read anything that has things in it attributed to Hitler that he didn't actually say. I don't care if it's just one part of it. You know, I'm supposed to ignore that part. So I just stayed away from it, and now I think that it is a very important book, and I'm glad we're going to be reading it because to understand Adolf Hitler totally. And once again, this idea that if he thought something or talked in a certain way in the 1920s doesn't mean he's still going to say exactly the same thing in the 1940s after
exactly.
All that had taken place.
Just sure. I mean, that's his growth as anyone. Life experience and exposure to all the things that happened and everything. Well, he's grown over those years quite substantially. So it would be foolish to think that he's going to say those same things, as he's aged, picked up different perspectives and things like this. I think certainly it's a sign of his maturation and the changes that he had as his life experience and very natural.
Well, he also went through some battles with church leaders. Mm-hmm. Somebody said, let me find that. Somebody said something that I thought was good, after studying Hitler for many years, this person writes, I believe that what Hitler believes is that our Western values are tied in with the Christian value system. That is obviously true. But when Hitler speaks of Christianity, he is talking about the Christianity that was of the times when Christ lived and not the phony Christians that we see today. Well, he goes on and on like that. I don't know if that's actually the one I was looking for. But the fact is that because Hitler was critical of Christianity and what we call churchianity today and things like that doesn't mean that they wanted to get rid of Christianity.
Right.
A couple of those phrases in translation are worded bad. One is that it's the Christian lie, and the other is the disease of Christianity. And you don't know, like you were talking about translations, you don't know that that's the best choice of words in English to use for what he said.
That's correct.
Yeah. So, you just have to overlook some things and kind of figure out what might, just let it go. But
That's
here's
right.
a woman who says, who's really against it. And she says on VNN forum, somebody put up this show announcement on VNN forum, and there was just a few comments there, mostly from this Sarah T., who said, "This show is a mistake, the one we're just starting tonight, since Hitler's Table Talk is fraudulent. Hitler's Table Talk is a French to English translation of Janu's German to French translation, to which Janu liberally added all sorts of bogus Hitler quotes." Well, see, I wish she would provide evidence of what mm-hmm. she says. Mm-hmm. But this is the case where what we find, if you look around on these forums, and a lot of what you find is from forums, people are just saying things, but they don't prove that it's true. Mm-hmm. So that's a big question. Oh, that's the only question that I have, is that what this book was, what these conversations were, if the English was translated from the German or from the French. But now let's go to David Irving, because David Irving makes it very clear. I should find what he says here. He makes it very clear that he, here it is, that he thinks they're genuine, and he's been burned before. In fact, he was burned by this Janu and Hitler's political testament, which was supposed to be the 1945 version of these talks around the table, or something like that. But it turned out to be a total forgery. But even after all the other forgeries he's seen, he thinks that this is very good. And he also says that he wrote this, the pages signed by Bohr. He says, "For 40 years or more, no German original was published, as Janu told me that he feared losing the copyright control that he exercised on them." Irving, in his favor, he does go around and talk to people personally, travels all over the place to do so.
Right.
He said, "I have seen the original pages, and they are signed by Bormann." So the ones that Janu got from Mrs. Bormann were the ones that Bormann had there that he had signed. And good for her for saving them. When she left Munich, she took those with her, the little that she could carry with her. She took those, and if she hadn't, I guess we wouldn't have this, hardly have this today, except for what Picker had. But he said they were signed by Bormann. Then he says they were expertly and literately translated. That is, so you can utter good English. Translated by Norman Cameron and R.H. Stevens, though with a very few, odd interpolations of short sentences, which don't exist in the original. The translator evidently felt justified in such insertions to make the context plain. Well, that's important. You often have to do that when you're translating, because as you were pointing out, you just can't do it. You can't do a word-for-word translation. You have to put it into the other language and make quite a few changes. But so a very few of these short sentences, which are put, are made clear that they're added, is not much. So I think that's quite a good recommendation. Mm-hmm. And with that, along with Hasso Kastrup, who I know and told me personally that he had gone through all this, and he thought this, because I was saying, well, I can't use this Trevor Roper translation. I just can't use that. It's too many questions about it. He said, there's nothing wrong with it. So then we kept going back and forth with that, till I was convinced that he meant that it really was all right. And so here we are, and I feel comfortable using this, translation now. It's the only one we have, so we have to use it.
Okay.
Yeah, you finish up, Ray, because we've only got a few minutes to go here.
I was just going to ask you if you saw what I saw in there. Remember reading about this Francois Janu, that when he took that, he decided to go ahead and try to get this thing printed. He took the manuscript to the publisher, and he demanded £40,000 in payment, which is quite a sum of money in those days. Well, and then that publisher argued with him a little bit, but then says, okay, and he's going to write out this check. He said, I can write out this check to you for £40,000. He said, no, write out two checks, £20,000 to me and £20,000 to Adolf Hitler's sister, who was still alive at the time, and having a very rough time making it financially and everything else. And so Genoux sympathies seemed to lie there, and I wondered if that was true. I mean, it seemed like it would be.
Well, I've read it in a number of places. I think it is.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Then this Genoux also, he was Swiss.
Yeah.
He was
Swiss.
Yeah.
That's right.
You know,
that's right.
not actually a Frenchman.
Frenchman.
He was a
yeah.
Swiss French. You know, because they're divided up into three different mm-hmm. languages in Switzerland. But that makes him closer. They say he was a National Socialist.
Uh-huh.
Why not believe it? Seems like when it comes to this, everybody wants to not believe anything that comes
yeah.
along. You know. Well, how do we know that? He was a banker or something. Well, bankers were National Socialists then. I don't know what kind of a banker he was, but obviously he wasn't poor. But he did do that. So I don't see any reason why he can't be trustworthy. The only one I don't like is Trevor Roper.
Exactly.
And oh, here's one last thing that as I went through trying to find everything I could written about this table talk, a lot of the commentary and criticism and things that people take as serious about it, you know, as take for what is true, comes from British historians. Ian Kershaw, who wrote lots of books about Hitler and the Third Reich, is one. And who are some of the others? But now they're the ones I don't trust. They really are anti-Hitler, and I'm not saying he didn't have anything to do with these translations or anything, so it doesn't matter. But what they say, I don't put faith in that in their commentaries about it and so on. So they say, well, this we can go by this because Kershaw thinks it's authentic. I think, well, that's fine, but I don't care whether he does or not. You know, I don't care what Kershaw has to say.
Right.
And I don't care what Trevor Roper has to say either. I thought that his preface would have been in this PDF. I hadn't looked at it, but I didn't want to read it. I was going to say I didn't think we should read it, but it's not even there. So.
Yeah.
Well, okay. Once again, you have the last. We've got 60 seconds, right?
Okay.
You have the last word.
Okay. Well, let me just say this: when I was teaching, I would occasionally use articles out of the Barnes Review, with permission, of course, and I would assign my class members to write a response paper to those articles. And there was a time or two when one of them would come up to me later and say, I looked up on the web about the Barnes Review, and it says it's just a racist, anti-Semitic publication. And I said, well, who's saying that? Who's telling you that? Why don't you read this article and make up your own mind? And you tell me, I don't know whoever the article's by, but you just tell me what you think about it. So, and that's what we want to do with this book here, make up our own minds.
Okay, very good. We do. And ladies and gentlemen, we'll be back next week to begin reading chapter.
Thanks for listening. Hitler's Table Talk Study Hour will return next week, exclusively on the White Network.